which is bizarre.
Yes, absolutely. Hi, everybody. This is Dean Haglin here in the Tony Las Feliz neighborhood in Los Angeles. Isn't it a Tony?
It's Rational Exuberance North.
All right. Our sub office.
Well, it's subsidiary. Our post-production facility.
That's right. I, of course, am Dean Haglin. And
you
this,
are. TV's Dean Haglin.
And you are filmmakers Phil Lernes.
Independent Films Phil Lernes.
That's right. And this is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
It's my Chilpack Hollywood Hour?
It's everyone's Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Yes, especially our loyal listeners.
Yes.
Legion as they are.
Well, and they certainly taught me a lesson about getting the show up on time, which I didn't.
Last week, you mean?
Yeah. Which we finally got up. Well, no, it was the week.
We did two last week, really.
Yeah. We did, didn't we?
Well, thanks to Jackalope Radio.
Bless them.
Many, many of our listeners check us out on Jackalope Radio twice a week. I believe it's Fridays at, I don't know what the times are. It's Central Standard Time, but you can find it at jackaloperadio.com.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the show streams twice a week, and that was how many people first heard our redo of the 007 show.
Which we finally got up. The curse is over. We're breaking the curse. Huzzah!
All that for a show that really blew.
That nobody agreed with our opinions at all. No.
You're I don't even know if we had opinions, really, to be on that show. I don't even know if we did.
I just like Thunderball. That's all. Just every answer was Thunderball.
And you didn't even know that was a James Bond film.
I know. I just like the name. Thunderball.
It was sung by Tom Jones, so
that's why.
Right there, how can
that and the New Mexico puppeteer.
Why did Tom Jones never play James Bond?
Oh,
one wonders.
My God,
that... I mean, when they were casting George Lazenby, didn't the name Tom Jones ever come
surely,
up?
Surely that, or probably got mixed up with Engelbert Humperdinck.
Well, he could have been James Bond.
I wouldn't love to see that.
Julio Iglesias could have been James Bond.
Wow. Well, anyway,
we spun off the rails.
We sure have, because we've just seen a director's cut, haven't
no,
we?
No, not a director. Are you kidding me?
What
that
cut
was the second
it?
Cut.
Second rough cut.
Yeah, well, you've got rough. The rough cut, and then you've got a revised cut.
Yes. What would you call it? Salmon? Is this double salmon? What
the
are
colors
they say?
In the scripts, for people who don't know, script revisions, when you're in production, script revisions, the pages come in different colors. And there's
in specific
a code,
order.
Yeah, of different ones. But there are films and television shows, I imagine, although I think in TV it's probably you're on such a fast pace that it would be hard to do too many revisions. But there are certainly cases where they've run out of colors.
Yes. So you have to go back over the list again. And it's happened on The X-Files, and the joke was we got to double salmon.
Double salmon.
Double salmon, which meant that it went past 12, 15 revisions.
You know, we really are overfishing the double salmon. And the farmed, never mind.
Never
the
mind.
Farmed double salmon. There's so many places I could have gone with that joke.
And but, thank God you didn't go to any of them.
But the point is, after 4.5 hours of watching the cut
yes.
of The Truth Is Out There, it's not that it's 4.5 hours. I mean, we had to discuss things, and we were swapping right. ideas back and forth, but it's hard work.
Hard work.
And
I'm
you know
not
when you're
you.
Editing this, it's very challenging because you can't really take the time to go out and look at the whole.
Right.
You're under the hood.
The
working.
Whole time.
You Put can't it. Be taking it out for a test drive while you're under the hood.
Assembling
things.
Yeah, exactly. So you have to look at it at the end of that.
I was pleased after the first cut, which was, you know, really amorphous.
Oh.
I was pleased.
I didn't get through it, to
I
tell
was
you the
pleased
truth.
By how you came across. I was also pleased by how the information was coming out. It was
yeah.
really it was making sense in terms of its presentation, and there was even in the 3.5 hour rough cut there was this momentum that was moving forward as the stories and as the information developed, and that was a concern. And of course, yeah. that was my focus on the first cut was cutting the information,
right.
cutting the stories that the experts were all telling.
Yeah, absolutely.
In this. Version, the emphasis not only went to, you know, cutting it down, we mm-hmm. cut it by more than a half hour, but also then shaping it so that the structure of your story started to emerge.
Right.
And there's still more work that needs to be done there, and then some balancing that needs to be done between those two.
Yeah, for sure. And speaking of balancing, I just actually kicked the mixer, but I got it now. I just rebalanced it. You were maybe a little hot there, but now it's good.
I am a little hot. So anyway, so there's still much challenge ahead of us.
Yeah.
What an undertaking.
Yeah.
I mean, we were supposed to be done quite a while ago, and I've been editing pretty much nonstop for 5 or 6 months now.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I always question the logging idea, but here I see where it really pays off in this stage. Because you watched all the original footage without thinking, just logging what everybody said and all that sort of thing. And I always think, man, can't you just sort of remember you were there behind the camera at all of it? But agreed, you know, there's things there that I totally forgot.
I would like to point out that logging was not supposed to originally have been my job.
Whose job was it?
Yeah, the person who was initially putting in all the...
That was me?
The footage. I don't want to log name that? Names, Dean Hagel.
Was I supposed to log that, too?
Yeah, that was going to be your job, and then no. I was going to take over. But it was fine. It worked out the way that it...
I was supposed to log... I thought I was just putting an input.
So that I could find the stuff, and yeah.
I didn't know that. Oh, well.
You missed that meeting.
I certainly did.
Anyway, but, you know, there's much to feel... There's so much good material.
Yes.
You know, that's one thing, is that some of our challenge is because there's so much good stuff.
Yeah.
Certainly preferable to not enough good stuff.
Yes.
You know, all these topics that we wanted to cover, we have a wealth of information, stories, attitudes, opinions about them. We have such a wide range of colorful and engaging and informed and opinionated people film.
Yeah.
And what's nice in watching this cut, you know, I asked you just before we started recording the show, does everyone come off good?
Yeah.
In the film, because that is a big concern for me, in not only because it's a documentary, but also true in narrative films as well. You know, it's important for me to get to the point as the storyteller that I really love all the characters. That doesn't mean that everyone's going to love all of them. I need to love all of them so that, you know, I can really understand where the different characters are coming from and all of this, because I don't want it to be a situation in a narrative film where I'm imposing my will upon them. And even though this is not a narrative, this is a documentary, we are taking certain narrative approaches. And part of that makes it even more important that I want all these people to come off well.
And remove your own bias.
Yeah, you can never do this. You know, I said this last week, you know, when we were talking about a little bit about Loose Change version 3 and the young man who made the Loose Change movies, how he said that, you know, he didn't have any agenda in making this. He was just asking questions. And I called him out on that about not having any agenda, because as we know, we all always have an agenda. No matter what we're doing, we have an agenda. And I didn't mean it that he was being duplicitous.
Right.
Most of the time, we're unconscious of what our agenda is.
An unconscious agenda.
Yeah, well, most of what we do in our life is motivated and controlled by things going on in our unconscious. And so our constant work is to try to take the unconscious and make it conscious.
Bring it to light.
Take our consciousness to our unconscious. Exactly, bring it to light. And especially when you're doing something like this, it becomes not just a matter of one's own personal quest, but then also one's sense of responsibility to, you know, all the different pieces in this film. In this case, all these different experts, all these different storytellers, honoring their commitment and their generosity to the project by then, you know, the metaphor, as silly as it sounds, is the idea of throwing a dinner party to me.
Mm.
You know, I've invited all these disparate people to the dinner party, and
you want a lively conversation, and you want
lively conversation and exchange, and you want everyone to have a good time,
right?
And you want everyone to feel welcome, and we are now going to open this dinner party to a larger audience.
Right. Fantastic.
And people might bring their own agenda to viewing it, and they might bring their own bias, and of course they will. And the audience are the people who are really going to create what this film means.
Right.
That's their responsibility. What we want to know is, hey, this is who these people are to the best of our ability, and we love them, and we think you'll love them as well.
Fantastic.
Right? And I felt in watching this with you right now that we're doing a really good job on this.
It's coming there.
Comes
yeah.
off it, really well.
I appreciate that. Yes. That everybody, their information as they laid it out was all intact. And
of course, you have to make selections.
Right.
You know, and...
But there were no trick edits, you know. There wasn't anybody speaking out of context. Wasn't
no,
like
no to try to create new meaning or whatever. Where's the fun in that? You know, like on our show here, you know, I've taken to task some of our experts right in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And
have you?
Of course, yes, I have. And yet at the same time, I think that it's easy for people to maybe misunderstand that a lot of times I take to task the people that I agree with the most.
Ah.
Right? You know, like I've talked about Bruno from We Are Change, mm-hmm. and, you know, we've talked about some of the legal problems he's facing, the challenges right now. And, but, you know, he has comments in our film that I agree with the most fundamentally.
Absolutely.
Even if I don't agree with how he got to those conclusions.
Right.
But he has some of the most important things in there. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it's important for me that people get to not only that they come off in a way that their message and that their information has its best chance of taking root or taking seed or whatever, but that people can see beyond just the message and the information and see the human being.
Right.
Right? Because right. as we've talked so much before about shooting the message, killing the messenger, shooting the messenger, you know, and it's like, again... Oh, I don't agree with what that person was saying. Oh, but that person moves me, or that person touches me, or that person delights me.
Right.
I mean, Bruno, for example, is charming as hell in this, don't you think?
I agree.
And we can't use all of his information. There are choices that we have to make because
right.
already it's too long at 3 hours, right?
3 hours.
We need to keep making choices. But, you know, hopefully they're choices that will inspire people to learn more about what the people are saying. And there are some other times, like some people who are more well known, like let's say your friend Alex Jones, you know, people know him or think they know him probably from his show. I saw him on that that History Channel 9/11 special.
Oh, right? I missed that. When was that on?
On the eve of 9/11.
Oh, right. I
we
was
talked about that a little bit last week.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I just think time and time again, it's really courageous of him to be on these shows because he's got to know that people are going to take pot shots at him, and they're going to, and he doesn't seem to care. Like he did Nightline, did a piece on him recently, you know?
Really?
And he's got to know that there's going to be side swipes or whatever, and he still does it. And what I like about, you know, for me and for some of the other people that I've shown this to, I've said, does he at least come off as well as he does on his own show?
Right.
Because that, I think, would be great. If he comes off as well as he does on his own show, then that's
a great
then
marker.
We've done surface, mm-hmm. service to that. And I've heard, and I can actually see this, that he comes off better because what we get to see in our film that people don't get to see who just maybe tune into his show is not just how funny he is because he'll use humor in his show,
right?
But kind of how fun... As opposed to funny.
Funny.
Fun. Right. And also generous.
And generous. That's the shocking thing, right? You would think that with all of these guys coming down on him and all that sort of thing, you sort of tend to close off and just sort of hunker down in your studio and you know, use your radio show to rail. But that he can balance that out with the generosity of spirit.
Absolutely.
Just to have me come in, out of the blue, that's even sweet.
Well, and in the little comments in between takes, that's what I like, you know, mm-hmm. is that you see the real human interaction that's taking place here, even as this other thing is being discussed.
Right.
You know, and so that's why, you know, we've talked about this movie a lot. Our documentary, The Truth Is Out There, coming soon everywhere.
Yes.
Look for it.
Remember.
But we've talked about this a lot, and, you know, I'm of two minds about this.
Uh-huh.
You know, on the one hand, as a filmmaker, you want the work to just end up speaking for itself.
Right.
Because I've talked about the challenges of this. We've talked back and forth about what we've learned and the people we've talked to and, you know, wrestling with choices that have to be made and then wrestling ourselves with things that we're learning or things that we witness. And, you know, there's part of me that you know, would like to just be able to make the movie and then let people come to the movie.
Right.
Because there's always the danger that, you know, we talk about being a credible spokesperson and being a good messenger. I want to do our film credit and not speak about it in a way that's going to turn people off about it. Nor do I want to make it seem like something it's not.
Right.
We talk about how bad that marketing is, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Making somebody think it's, and then it turns out to be something else. So you always want to, just can't they just see the movie?
Right.
At the same time, we have a lot of aspiring filmmakers or filmmakers or artists or storytellers, creative people of all different types. And the truth is we both do want to be part of a larger conversation that's not just about this film or that film, but about how creative
processes
work
and take place. And in this culture and in this time, you know, that's the other thing is like, you know, the economics of all of it. I'm sure we'll be talking that through the upcoming episodes as we take this on the road. And,
so you run the risk always of, you know, talking your own project to death or turning someone off to it or promising them something it's not. You take that risk of somehow publicizing it in a way that you wouldn't want to.
Right.
If you or
that you wouldn't normally, like, this conversation wouldn't happen if it was an interview with Entertainment Weekly.
Exactly. Right? No. And so you run that risk in the hope that, well, maybe what we're going through and what we're sharing will somehow inspire or help or inform someone else.
Right.
And then we've had some minor, we've played our role somehow in a way that's larger than just us and our film.
Exactly.
And hopefully it serves.
Hopefully. And then you also get an appreciation of everyone else's film. Like, you know, yeah, when you go see other movies, you go, wow, good for you for even getting that up on the screen. That's what I always say now every time, no matter how bad, you know, you ask me, how can I see all these pop culture movies that I go to?
Right.
And you just, how can I? Because they got it up that somehow everybody got together and made that movie and it got on screen. Even if it was a studio picture and it was run by a machine, there's still something that's a major accomplishment to getting something.
You know, I, this is going to sound very bizarre, but I, no. Surprise coming from me.
Here we go.
You know, there are times when I get just so locked in the editing of this film. It's so frustrating. It is almost overwhelming. And that's what's interesting also about making this film at this time about this topic, because much of what motivates is this sense of overwhelm that people feel.
Right.
So naturally, there's going to be times when I immerse myself, if we've done our job right in shooting,
right,
in inviting voices and inviting people to come and talk, there are going to be times when I'm going to feel completely overwhelmed by all of it. But, you know, I'll find some dead end about it creatively.
Right.
Or I won't want to think about it anymore, and yet I'm so immersed in it, I can't think of anything else but it.
Mm.
Or I don't want to talk about it, but we've got a podcast, and what are we supposed to talk about except what we know?
Right.
And so all these things, and one day I was reminded about this wonderful gift that I was given, these limited edition cards that were made by Brian Eno.
What?
And they're these cards that I have over there on my
playing cards?
No, they're cards like playing card size, but on each one of them is just on the back is just a sentence or a question or a task, and they are all designed to help you break out of some kind of emotional, mental, intellectual, creative impasse by
what?
Just getting you to think or move or do in a different way than you ordinarily do. So you randomly draw from the deck and you do. So I decided to do a run of three cards as if I was like doing a mini tarot, right? Run of three cards because I figure, okay, I wasn't feeling good physically. I was feeling the stress of this project. My head was locked in knots about all these things. My spirit was suffering because I couldn't see the light at the end of the tunnel. So I go, okay, mind, body, spirit, the three components.
There you go.
I'll take a card for each.
Okay.
We'll go mind, body, spirit in that order. And the card that I took, believing that it would be somehow ease for my mind, get me out of the mind trap I was in, was to rid myself of an axiom. How Jeez. Perfect is that for a wow. for a mental exercise for the mind? Perfect.
And I wouldn't know how to do that. Wait. Rid yourself of an axiom.
Of an axiom. So what axioms do you accept as axiomatic?
I don't even know. Define axiom.
Axiom is the good of the many outweigh the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few.
Right.
For some ends people, justify that would be an axiom. Okay. The ends justify the means, or
fake it till you make it.
Something. So although that might be more of an adage than an axiom.
An adage.
But you know what I got into when I was like this whole thing of you know, wanting to honor the voices and wanting the film to be able to make its own friends and do this, and at the same time wanting to play this role as podcast host and, you know, your friend in podcasting.
Your friend in podcasting.
And, you know, just... And I realized somebody said this thing to me that I'd always accepted as axiomatic. Well, there's no such thing as bad publicity.
Oh.
There's an axiom, and there's an axiom I've always believed. There's no such thing as bad publicity. However, I looked at it in a new way, and I got rid of it. There is no such thing as bad publicity. That also means there's no such thing as good publicity.
Oh.
There is only... Publicity.
Right.
And it is neither good nor bad.
It's valueless.
It is publicity.
Yeah.
Period. And that freed me because I realized, you know what? We never get to know what's going to inspire someone to engage with you. We're never going to know what's going to inspire someone to see your film. Story. I made Party Crashers. Party Crashers had this theatrical release. I went to one of the theaters where it was playing one day in San Jose, California, the town theater, and a tiny little crowd, you know, like four people in an afternoon screening. And I see this one man walking out alone, and I just decide I'm going to sidle up over to him and engage him. And I just said, sir, I'm curious, you know, this film doesn't have big marketing. It doesn't have what inspired you to come and see this film? And he said, oh, I read a review in Metro.
Ah.
Okay, well, that makes sense, right? Reading reviews sometimes get people to the smart houses,
right, as we
call them. And I then thought about it, and I said, but wait a minute, that critic hated the movie, didn't he? I forget the critic's name, actually. Right. I'm sorry, but the hates this movie.
Said, is this the one you're the death of filmmaking?
No. This is someone else.
That's
this
my
was
favorite.
Someone about just, you know, I'm from the Bay Area. I was raised in the Bay Area. This was someone who's all about just pissing on the local boy because we hate it when...
The local kid makes a film.
Makes successful, right?
Yeah, right.
I said he hated the film, didn't he? And this man said, yeah, but that critic's a known idiot. And that's so telling.
Oh,
this guy went to see the film because of the awful review it got, because he has judged if this critic hates something, he will love it.
Right.
You never know.
Right.
So there's no such thing as a bad review.
And
there's just a review.
And same thing, if he gave it a good review, that guy wouldn't have seen it
because
that guy's an idiot.
And so there's just publicity, and there's just putting yourself out there and trying to put yourself out there as authentically as you can. And yeah, sometimes it really is that struggle of balancing wanting the work to speak for itself. And at the same time, this is our work too, which is speaking about the work.
It's getting rid of an axiom. Well, Brian Eno, you did it again. Well done with your card set.
Love this. One of the ones, the one that I drew for Spirit.
Uh-huh.
Take a blank canvas.
Uh-huh.
And put it in a frame that is of great value to you.
Oh. So I don't have to paint anything. I just frame it.
Yeah. Frame a blank canvas and any kind of canvas.
Indeed.
And for me, that really spoke to me because, again, it was about the artistry of embracing the space between.
Right.
The unknown.
Wow.
You know, the important role that projection plays in life and especially in art.
Right.
We all project onto these canvases anyway.
And it's so awesome.
Based on how much value we deem that it has.
Right.
I mean, that's the thing. If the frame has great value, well, what's within must have great value.
And the art gallery in Boston that the woman who was the great collector in the turn of the century who brought art, Felder, Felder, the Felder Art Museum.
Felder? I didn't even know you knew her.
You brought her, you Felder. No, I think that's the, I can't remember. Anyway, they had an art robbery, but she had in her will that it must exactly stay as is, so they leave up the empty frames where the art was stolen from. And it's actually way more. So it just says at the bottom, like, you know, it'll say Cezanne or whatever, like the name of the artist. But then it's just a blank wall with a frame around it. And you go, wow, isn't that like your mind just puts the painting in there more than probably what the painting is or was.
Right.
And they still haven't recovered the art. But I've been watching Art Thieves all week on Ovation Television, my new favorite channel.
You know, I think in trying to take this concept of, you know, publicity, mm-hmm. because you need to let people know about the thing that you're doing, right? And how can you do it ever more in a way that serves the film? And, you know, I keep coming back to this idea that, you know, you need to try to serve the film. Obviously, there's that financial sense that you need to serve it because you want to make money. But in the long run, honesty and integrity and authenticity serves the film. Don't market and sell a film of something it isn't.
Yeah.
Well, like, have you seen these trailers for Never Let Me Go? Never Let Her Go, Never Let Me Go, the Keira Knightley, Carrie Mulligan
thing? Yeah.
What have you thought of these trailers?
I wasn't sure what the movie is.
Well, no, you can't really tell, and these trailers go on forever, and it seems kind of like a sort of an atonement sort of movie. Yeah. And this,
like, you know, Ivory Merchant something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, how about the fact that it's a science fiction film?
What?
Yeah. It's a science fiction film. I don't want to ruin anything about this, so I won't go. But I just want to tell people that this is based on a novel, and if you do enough, you know, if you look up the novel, it was considered maybe the best science fiction novel of the past decade. And the film, no matter how it looks from that trailer, I've talked to who's seen it, yeah, it's a science fiction thriller.
Oh. Well, you wouldn't get that from those.
No, not at all, would you?
No.
Now, here is a case of certainly they're not giving anything away. God bless them.
Right.
But are you really serving the film? And again, I don't mean to be, you know, criticizing them in the sense that maybe, you know, God forbid the marketing department had no clue about this. Like, we don't know what to do. Because sometimes, as we know, great films are very hard to market.
Right. And as we once said, the marketing should be already...
You should know how you're going to do this.
You know how you do
and
this.
This is
film
the thing.
It into the.
You know, I want to make. You know, I'm making after this. I'm going to make Night Falls Fast. You know, about suicide. You know, inspired by what I witnessed. Mm-hmm. You know, our community go through in the wake of Philip Newby killing himself, and what I witnessed gets visited upon close-knit communities, and how communities come together and how they're split apart. You know, in the wake of this, and. You know, so then the question becomes, you know, how do you publicize such a thing in a way that does honor to the film, that does honor to the memory, that does honor and all these things?
It's not sensationalist. It's not
a slant film. Part of it, of course, is, look, this is how much I think the film should cost. I want it to cost an amount of money where the investors will see their money back for being willing to pay for something that may not be on first blush something so commercial simply because, oh, this is a valuable story that might inspire people, might encourage people, might give them a little bit of information or point them in a direction, or at least make them feel like, hey, we're all in this together.
Right.
And so what do you do? And of course, one of the things that was very obvious for me in this was that, you know, the screenings of it, the theatrical screenings of it, will be, you know, from city to city for the purposes of raising money for suicide prevention organizations in that area.
Right.
Education and prevention organizations, they'll get the money from it. That doesn't help make the money back for the investors. What it does, though, is it does spread the word about the film. People do find out about the film.
Yeah.
And at the same time, the film is already fulfilling its larger function, which is its role within society and hopefully helping people and hopefully inspiring people. And so you try to do something like that. With a film like this, you know, Lyle and I have been talking about the fact that what we would very much like to do is set up screenings in addition to our film festivals and things like this, but set up screenings for working with each of our experts. Like, you know, some of them obviously are people who work with organizations. Like with Bruno, We Are Change, or with Gemma Bulos, the single drop for water rights and clean water access around the world. You know, and setting up private screenings that can perhaps not only raise money and awareness for their particular activity, or if it's an individual, for a cause that matters to them. What would they like to shine a spotlight on and to raise money for them? And working with these people to help. And then you're getting the name of the film out there. And of course, also, we're helping these experts who were friends enough to come in and help the film.
Right. And then, but this goes then a counter to Scott Pilgrim versus the World. Now, one of the marketing criticisms was that they showed it for free to everybody who would have paid to see it. So they basically specifically found the, you know, comic book nerdy, quote, nerdy audience
in the face
and,
of that.
And then they the rumor was about 8,000 to 10,000 people saw that, and they were pretty much the market. Right. And anyone who didn't get to a free screening just didn't happen to be at the right convention.
And here's two arguments. There's a few different arguments against this.
Right.
One was the idea, look, even if all those people who saw it for free didn't see it for free, and even if all those people had paid to see it, the film's still a huge financial disaster.
Right.
You went from being a huger financial disaster to a slightly less huge financial disaster. Also, at the same time, those people seemed to like it. So are we sure they didn't go see it again?
Right.
There's no way of knowing that.
Right.
And also, when it comes out on video, aren't those the people who are likely to buy it?
Mm. Well, that's a tough call.
And then you look at our film. You've just seen it. This is not a film that people, if they are engaged by it, this is not a film that people are going to see once. We really are making a documentary that will inspire, if we continue to do our job right and finish this to term, it will inspire multiple viewings.
Mm-hmm.
Because the more you peel the onion on this, really the more fun it's going to be.
Yeah.
So that's the opportunity here. And also then we
peel the onion is a great metaphor for our website too.
So the and then the other difference, of course, is Scott Pilgrim versus the World, $80 million film,
right?
With all that marketing expense versus us making a $150,000 film,
right? That's true. So we do have a bit of a leg up.
We have a leg up in that everything was designed around grassroots,
right? And it's like my hero Guy Maddin. He said the worst filmmaking experience he had was the film that cost the most money. He said that his greatest artistic and creative stuff came from the movies that cost $20,000.
And we've talked about this before, that in so many of these new methodologies, it's about branding.
Mm-hmm.
The important thing is branding. And how do you create the brand? And what is the brand that you're creating?
Don't even know yet.
Well, hopefully for this, part of that brand is to be part of these communities.
Yeah, that's true. But is that a brand? I guess it is.
Why can't it be?
I don't know.
Why can't it be? I mean,
you're right. I got to read my 22 Immutable Laws of Branding book again.
Yeah, and then find one of those axioms
and
let
it.
Go of it.
And send it to Brian Eno.
Hey, did you watch Boardwalk Empire on HBO last night?
I did not. I'm curious. How did you...
Talk about why you're curious. Will I get you a chill pack?
Oh, thank you. Yes, we need a chill pack under my laptop. Curious, because it's Martin Scorsese, and I hear it's basically the prequel to what The Sopranos was. If The Sopranos is the future of gangster, the Broadway... Or Boardwalk Empire is what the...
Kind of the classic greatest hits.
Yes, exactly.
It really might be something. It really,
really
might be a show. I mean, this first hour and 15-minute pilot movie, not created by, executive produced, co-executive produced, and directed by Martin Scorsese.
Right.
Created by Terrence Winter.
Right. Yeah, who did Terrence Winter worked on this
Sopranos?
Sopranos, okay. Wasn't he? Yeah,
and it's also executive produced by Mark Wahlberg.
Mm-hmm. Entourage.
Yeah, Timothy Van Patten.
I have his
son
dog
of
food.
Dick Van Patten.
Yes, yeah. And I get his Dick Van Patten dog food.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's delicious.
That's nice of you to go and get him dog food. Soon he will be on solid food. It was really, really fun, and I'm curious as to how it will be when it isn't directed by Martin Scorsese.
Right, because did you just see Martin Scorsese touch us all over the place?
Yeah.
Or was the story
so
compelling?
It's so expensive looking and just beautiful, the period detail. Which
is he's known for, period detail.
And it was, and yet, when you think back to Scorsese, you know, his origins, Mean Streets and Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore and his documentary, the Woodstock documentary, you know, imagine, would you automatically think big budget period detail guy?
No, I wouldn't, not till.
And it's fun that he really learned his storytelling technique and honed his directorial style and his work with actors and,
though you know my opinion of Scorsese.
I know, but
it's the editor that saved those early ones.
Thelma Schoonmaker, Schoonmaker was a technical advisor on this.
Oh, look at, they're still working together.
So
thank goodness.
Anyway, that was quite
as a technical
lot.
Advisor. That means she was standing over the shoulder of the editor, just saying, "Cut this and do that."
I don't know, or advising with Marty during the making of it.
Whatever.
I call him Marty.
You know, the thing I said to Bobby De Niro about name dropping?
I said never name drop.
Name drop. With
Bobby
Marty.
De Niro told me never name drop. You know, you gave me an assignment week about Claude Chabrol.
Yes.
The great French director.
Who passed away last week.
Founder of the French New Wave.
Yes.
And very interested. You know, he's been called... Hitchcock, France's Alfred Hitchcock.
Right.
And, you know, that's an easy marketable term, and it works to help get some of his films released here and everything.
Right.
It also is a little...
disingenuous.
Bit of a disservice when you consider, you know, the man's prolific output, the variety of genres in which he worked, and also his true passion for... the psychology of his characters, especially the psychology of people under duress. So he was much more than that. I did a count, and now I've lost. I didn't bring the piece of paper or whatever, but I think it was like 53 feature films.
Wow.
Two segments of other films, two or three segments of, you know, like collections, sometimes these films like Paris Chatham, not that he did Paris Chatham, but where many filmmakers come together and do short pieces.
Right.
So that's in addition to the 53 features, a bunch of television movies, television episodes, but I mean 53 features.
That's a lot.
In his career. And one documentary feature.
Really?
And I was trying to figure out, you know, how do I put together a list of what people might want to see?
Yes, the best of Claude.
And so I kind of... What I decided was, much like I did with the James Bond, I went to IMDb, and instead of this just being my personal beliefs, my personal favorites, I went to what got the best collective ratings among users of Internet Movie Database, and then decided I'll talk about these plus one.
Okay.
So...
'cause you're you have the entire Claude Chabrol collection, aren't you?
Well, no. I mean, not 53. When I was in distribution, working for Cinema Arts and Artides, we represented the rights to maybe 14 or 15 of his films.
Oh, well, I
from
thought
kind
were...
of his sort of his prime period.
The sellable window.
No, I mean, but, you know, the early classics we didn't have, and then some of his biggest international hits... which were in the 80s, after he had landed this status as international as Claude Chabrol.
Right.
So some of these films, from 1971, one of the ones that I did represent, Juste Avant la Nuit, or Just Before Nightfall, which won the British Academy Award for Best Actress, even though it was a French language film for Stéphane Audron, who was at that time Mrs. Chabrol, and who starred in many of his films. And it's a lot of fun.
What's this one?
Crime and infidelity. A lot of his favorite themes, crime and infidelity and sadomasochism, all while focusing on the life of an insurance agent.
Wow. Well, I can see that, actually.
Yeah, of course totally. You can. That's what's so brilliant, about the topic. I mean, he's really fun. And also, again, the Hitchcock comparison, why I don't think it's fair. I feel like Chabrol was very passionately involved and interested in class warfare.
Mm.
Not only in the sense of the political warfare, but again, in the psychological dehumanism that takes place when we allow ourselves to be seen, or we see ourselves through class identity.
Right. And so if
he's... For everyone. That those boxes that we're in, no matter what the class identity...
But what was his own upbringing? Was he part of the proletariat, or was he bourgeoisie family?
You didn't ask me to look that up.
Oh, sorry. I thought you would just know that automatically.
No, I've got so much. I'm doing three and a half hours of a documentary. I can't believe it. 1970, maybe my favorite, La Rupture, or The Breach, as it's known.
The Rupture.
In America.
Yeah.
Again, Stéphane Audron and Jean-Pierre Cassel, one of the great French actors of all time. A crime is committed by a mentally ill husband, husband of Stéphane Audron. A crime is committed against their son by a mentally ill husband, certifiably mentally ill.
Against
his own son. And so the wife has to protect her son and get him committed for everyone's well-being.
Right.
And then a battle takes place between his family and her. They try to drive her insane. They try to discredit her at every turn so that they can get, having now feeling like they've lost their son, they want her son. And so it's this battle that goes on, and her battle to maintain. And, all the while, for her and her ill husband, who is hopefully getting help, to continue and maintain and deepen their relationship of love.
Ooh.
That is still a loving relationship.
Dear
In spite
God.
Of all these things. Yeah, how about
Wow.
That's a rich brew.
I'd say.
So, La Rupture. 1995, I think maybe the most recent I have on this list, La Ceremony, which did pretty well here in the States and did well internationally, starring Isabelle Huppert, who starred in many American films.
Mm-hmm.
Again, Jean-Pierre Cassel, Jacqueline Bisset.
Look at that.
Why miss it with Jackie Bisset? Again, his touchstone themes, all about class conflict. And this one, the shame of illiteracy and what those feelings of shame can inspire us to do.
Even more than The Reader? Well, you didn't see The Reader.
I did see The Reader. We talked about this. But again, this is well before The Reader.
Isn't that something?
So he was dealing with this in 1995.
That's the shame of illiteracy.
So The Ceremony. La Ceremony.
Okay.
Couple others I got on here. 1969, you got to have this, La Femme Infidèle, The Unfaithful Wife, which was, of course, remade as Unfaithful by Adrian Lyne, in addition, again, to Stéphane Audron, his wife at the time, who he has played the unfaithful wife.
Yeah.
I wonder, you know,
how
much did he enjoy
scenes.
The psychology of putting her through those? Who knows? And Michel Bouquet, who I always liked, and Maurice Roné, who starred in a really fun early kind of spy parody that Chabrol made called Who's Got the Black Box?
Oh, that's fun.
Anyway, they starred in La Femme Infidèle, that was the basis for the American remake, Unfaithful. And there's always been to me something fairly tawdry and vulgar about the American remake.
Oh?
That isn't true of the French original.
Ah.
Somehow the translating into different cultures.
Right, because the French have the mistress and the thing, and it's not so...
It's more culturally ingrained, and here
there's
always somehow, there's always this thing about movies like this in America where if you play it too much towards the titillation factor, it can be tawdry and vulgar.
Right.
If you step away from it, then it almost is lifeless.
Right. So you have to have that balance in there.
It's tough. In it other tough. Words, it needs to be French.
Well,
and I found this while making Story of O.
I got to say, the Unfaithful America version, I appreciated its ambiguous ending.
Okay.
Where the, you know, the two of them in the vehicle, and the vehicle just stops in the small town or is on the road.
Should there be spoiler alert?
No, everybody's seen Unfaithful. How long is that?
Everyone has seen it.
Anyway.
We have a lot of young listeners, you know, on our show.
Well, when you see Unfaithful, it's an ambiguous ending. That's not spoiling. You can't spoil in an ambiguous ending.
How about 1970, Le Boucher, The Butcher? Again, Audran plays a repressed school teacher in a provincial town where she befriends a butcher. All the while, the town is being plagued by a series of Jack the Ripper-type murders.
I would assume it's The Butcher.
Well, maybe you would assume right, maybe you would assume wrong. So,
wow.
Again, sexual repression, mores, provinciality, class consciousness, Jack the Ripper-style murders. I have that over on my shelf.
Do you
the
really?
Butcher. Yeah.
And delicious food? Does the food look good in that movie? Because, you know, the French, the delicious meals. I was just there, and so I'm missing great French. I love a lamb.
1988, Story of Women, maybe his most famous film at this point, won Best Foreign Language Film Awards all over the world, nominated for Golden Globe for Best Foreign Language Film, wasn't eligible for the Oscars here, nominated for top prizes in France, the César Awards, and it starred Isabelle Huppert and Francois Clouzet. One, really a very interesting film, 1969, The Beast Must Die. Based on the novel The Beast Must Die by Nicholas Blake, an American novel.
Right.
The French title of the film actually was This Man Must Die. But it's about a single father obsessed with murdering the hit-and-run driver who killed his only child.
Ah.
Sound familiar?
Yeah.
It might, because it was remade by Sean Penn as the crossing guard.
Oh.
So very interesting. The original is very, very interesting, as is the remake.
So basically, I could take anyone at Claude Chabrol and remake it as an American film and do well.
Well, that's why we remade Unfaithful. The Cinema Arts and Artides remade La Femme Infidèle and remade it.
That
was done
in
house, don't you know?
I didn't know that.
Pierre Richard Mueller, executive producer of Unfaithful.
What?
Yes.
I got to read that credit again.
Yeah.
Get out of town.
And then the last one is his one documentary, which brings this full circle as we're talking about our documentaries.
Absolutely.
And how I was saying earlier when we were watching it, I want to stay away from the documentary motif of, you know, using so much footage and using photos and using illustrations when people are talking about things, because I want people to see the people who are telling this story.
Right.
Obviously, if we need something to help explain it or whatever, we'll use it. But I want people to see the people that you're talking to so that they can get a sense of this person. Because again, I think that they all come off quite nice.
Yeah.
I mean, I love everybody who's in our film.
Right.
You know, even when I disagree with them or whatever, I love all these people. And I think that the people who will, there's a very good chance that the people who watch the film will as well. And I think that we diminish that if we start cutting away to photos or
footage.
Stock footage or this in order, because then we're starting to place the emphasis on the information that they're telling more than the person telling it.
Which is part of the whole thematic thing.
We want the film to be generous, and we hope to inspire a generosity in the people who watch it to engage with viewpoints that are not their own.
And you're saying Claude Chabrol did this very thing?
No, I'm saying he did exactly the opposite.
Oh, is that
in
right?
In a documentary.
Oh.
I can't even pronounce the word anymore. My French is so bad. L'Aile de Vichy, the Eye of Vichy.
The Eye of Vichy, yeah.
The Eye of Vichy. And this is the one documentary feature he made. It was narrated in French by Michel Bouquet, and in English, the English world release of it was narrated by Brian Cox.
Wow.
And it's all about the Vichy occupation of France during World War II.
And all the
visuals of the film are archived pictures from newsreels that were broadcast in theaters throughout France during the Vichy occupation.
So they're sort of pro-Nazi.
So it's the eye of well, yeah, I mean, it's this very intriguing propaganda because it was trying to cultivate a national identity of Vichy. No, we are not the Nazis. Jeez, we are still, look at us, we are still French, you know,
right.
But this,
even though, and they were, but
this
they had
completely to... manufactured image.
Mm.
And of course, why it's still so interesting today is you're talking about 1940 to 1944, before Madison Avenue, before marketing campaigns, and yet really the media, never mind manipulation, but the media creation of images.
Wow. I'd like to see that.
So that
anyway, sounds pretty good.
I think I did an honorable job of remembering Claude Gibrault and hopefully suggesting some films that people might want to see.
I might take home the one you have here, The Thing with the Thing, maybe.
The Thing with the Thing.
Yeah.
Casting news.
Oh, yes. Who got cast? I'm working? Am I doing something?
Sacha Baron Cohen.
Oh, yeah.
Signed to play Freddie Mercury in a Queen movie about Queen.
Biopic.
Now, I love the fact that who would you get to write the movie about Queen, but Peter Morgan, who won an Oscar for writing The Queen.
Exactly. That's how they found him, actually.
Still kind of the go-to guy of historical dramas
with an emotional
that are
core.
Character-based and that are innovative and interesting.
Kind
of
cool.
And I got to tell you, I'm excited by that casting choice. Never mind the fact that he looks kind of like it, and he is such a physical performer and can embody the characters he's playing.
Can he sing that high register?
Well, you know...
He doesn't have to.
Think of his performance in Sweeney Todd that was quite interesting.
Oh, that was good.
I wouldn't put past him the ability to really pull this off. It doesn't mean it's going to be a good film.
No.
Right? Or that we need this film. I would say, though, is if it's going to be a good film, casting him could prove to be brilliant.
Right.
It could also prove to really take this thing off the rails.
Undermine it completely.
What you love from the standpoint, though, of the casting is they're clearly thinking outside the box and they're not playing this safe. And there's at least an indication that there's a real viewpoint here.
Yes. That sort of seems to be the thing. But I'm trying to think, what other A-lister would you even pull into that to do? I mean, if Sasha did not exist, who else would you possibly
cast?
Well,
you said what other A-lister, and I think you're wrong if you call him an A-lister.
Really?
Excuse
me, Borat, that movie did millions.
Yeah, and Bruno did okay.
Right.
And... But A-list is this idea of being able to open a movie, and he hasn't proven that he opens a movie.
Oh, yeah. I guess that's true.
Because it was Borat. That character opened
that
movie.
That's true, right? Yeah.
That was the brand already.
He was pre-branded.
So, and I'm not saying he can't. I mean, it kind of feels to me almost like casting early Peter Sellers. There's
right,
a real
the
unknown
work.
Quality about this, but he's not yet Peter Sellers.
Right. It's not Peter Sellers we know. That is pretty cool. Well, I'm going to be interested. I don't know much about the story of the Queen.
Well, it's being written now.
No, but I mean the actual biography of Queen itself. I enjoyed their Bohemian Rhapsody, as everyone did in high school. But I didn't go out and buy all their albums and follow them slavishly from concert tour to concert tour.
Now, in the little time we have left, what are you looking forward to? Is there anything you're looking forward to seeing?
Not really.
I'm really looking forward to Red on October 15th. I don't know a lot about it, but it's a spy film about a crack cadre of CIA spies that are... at retirement age. So apparently the CIA has to retire them.
Oh.
Because they know too much. You know how I love that kind of story.
Yeah,
line.
Totally.
So you've got little elements of the Expendables. You've got elements of the prisoner. You got elements of a Bourne Identity. And the spies, the Over the Hill gang, led by Bruce Willis and Helen Mirren.
Oh, my gosh.
John Malkovich.
Wow.
Morgan Freeman.
Look at that.
Looks like it could be a lot of fun.
That's a lot of fun.
So I'm looking forward to that.
That's pretty cool. That sounds like Space Cowboys set in Spy World.
That sounds terrible.
Yes, it does, doesn't it?
Wow.
I'm just saying it could go either way.
You turned me off on that. You know what else I'm looking forward to? And I want to go to this.
Okay.
October 30th.
Ah.
As an answer to Glenn Beck's Restore Honor rally that drew 80,000.
Right.
Unless you listen to him, in which case it was
9 million.
Easily 500,000.
Yeah.
And then you listen to his producer who says anyone who tells you that it was less than a million should not be believed or listened to about anything. And then you go, but wait, Glenn said it was a half million.
Yeah. I don't believe
him. But John Stewart's holding a Restore the Sanity rally
while
on the mall.
Stephen Colbert's.
While a rival rally is being held by Stephen Colbert.
Keep the fear.
March to keep fear alive.
Yeah.
October 30th on the mall in Washington. I want to go.
I thought it was September 30th.
No, I think it's October 30th. Well, we'll have to look into this.
Yeah.
But I want to go because, you know, according to
10-10-30. You're right.
Stephen Colbert, there's, you know, America is built on three bedrock principles, right? Freedom, liberty, and fear. Fear that someone will take away our freedom and liberty.
Yep.
That there are dark and optimistic forces that are threatening to take away our fear.
Right.
And replace it with rationality and reason. That was the other thing that he said that was so hysterical. People want to take our fear and replace it with reason. And he reminds us that reason is only one letter away from treason.
Yeah, that's right.
Which the reasonable among us would say is just coincidental. But I don't think America can take that risk. So anyway, I'm looking forward to doing that. What are you reading?
Let's see. I got some new books, actually. You know what I'm reading? I picked up a graphic novel while at a grocery store in France. So it's all in French.
What?
Yeah, and it seems to be a French version of The Black Pirate. Mm. So we're reading. I'm practicing my French, reading pirate graphic novels. Is that pretty cool?
Nice.
Yeah, that's what I'm reading.
I'm
Noir.
Still reading China Mielville's The City in the City.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I've been reading Paul Laviolet, PhD's Beyond the Big Bang.
Oh, yes. As seen
in the documentary. The documentary The Truth is Out There. You can find every installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour at our official site, mm-hmm. chillpackhollywood.com, chillpackhollywood.com.
So easy.
You can download and stream us,
mm-hmm.
And even subscribe via iTunes through our website.
I insist you do.
You can find the most recent show.
Yes.
Each week on MySpace at myspace.com/chillpackhollywood, where you can become a friend of the show. We had a couple more friends added this
really?
Week. Oh. And we always post a blog there each week previewing the next week's show.
We're still using it.
Become a liker.
Please
of the
like
show
us.
On Facebook. A year ago, we had just started on Facebook. We had like 200 something likers. Seriously, a year ago, and we were saying by the end of 2010, we wanted 1,000 likers.
How many?
And we're at like 760.
We're almost there.
Now. So help us get 1,000 likers. You listeners on Jackalope Radio, become a liker on Facebook, facebook.com/chillpackhollywood, and let us know
it's
that
so
you
easy.
Found us through Jackalope. That would be exciting.
That would be fun. Absolutely.
As always, we're brought to you by
Chill Pack.
You heard, I don't know if you could hear this. I'm absolutely serious about this. Our computers, our laptops, were making so much noise.
The fans were going off. The heat was going crazy.
They were slowing down.
Yep.
And I went and slid Chill Packs fresh out of the freezer underneath both of them. They drew the heat away from the CPU.
Mm-hmm.
These things are running silently. They're running fast. And heat is a very complicated problem that not only affects the performance of your laptop computer, but really will... over a not too long period of time affect really its lifespan.
It's lifespan.
So. And because the heat will actually warp the core.
Warp the hard drive.
Yeah.
Yep.
So don't just take my word for it, although I am a proud user and I give these as gifts. They're the perfect gift because they're environmentally friendly, easy to use, free shipping.
Free shipping still.
Anywhere in the world. Check it out for more information at chillpack.com, chillpak.com. Finally, Dean Haglund's on Twitter.
I am. Follow me at D Haglund.
And follow me at
Phil Lairness. Yeah, your full name.
Okay.
I just I went with D Haglund. I was more, that's my rapper name.
Yeah. Mine would be P Lair.
P Lair, yeah.
Till next week, I am P Lair.
You're P Lair. I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.